I sent a few papers in advance thinking we could discuss them, and Nina and probably Andrew picked a couple of them. And I hope you've had a chance to have a look at them. One is on Stafford beer. Right, picture of Stafford beer. From the journal Kybernetes, which I picked because it connects to the theme of information in a way. And the other paper was from a book called The Dark Universe, which addresses issues of politics. I think it's interesting. People care a lot about what the politics of cybernetics is. I reread the Kybernetes piece on Stafford Beer the other evening, and I was struck by how many nasty and confusing typos there are in it.
Yeah.
You noticed that, Sam?
Yeah.
It's just incredible, you know. Completely changing the meaning of sentences. And I really don't know how it got published like that. They must have obviously not consulted me. I'm quite good at proofreading things. So I apologize for them. I hope you can get through them. As I understand it, my job is to talk for like 15 minutes or so, give an introduction, break the silence, and then Simon will do the same. There's a Cambridge connection here, which I thought I'd mention. I wrote my book, The Mangle of Practice, mainly here in Cambridge when I was on sabbatical here in 1992 to 1993. And I remember that back in those days, Simon generously read everything I wrote and gave his usual incisive commentary, as he is going to do again in 10 minutes. And the connection is that many years after I wrote that book, I realized that cybernetics was a field which was somehow, I would say, reflexive to the mangle, meaning that the cybernetician's cybernetic project somehow acted out in practice what I'd thought of as pure description of scientific practice in the mangle, in the book. And this acting out of my and theoretical understanding is something that still fascinates me. Okay, I should say something about substance. to get a grip on what's interesting about cybernetics, I think the key thing to think about is ontology, meaning very simply understandings of what the world is like. And the important thing here is that cybernetics had a different ontology from that of the modern science. In that strong sense, cybernetics was and is a different paradigm from the sciences we all grow up with, we're all taught as children. And I remembered this morning this phrase that Ian Hacking used to have. He had the idea of a big paradigm. A little paradigm would just be a technical thing, a small technical shift, or big paradigms, which include science, ways of going on, worldviews, cultures, things like that. I understand cybernetics as being a big paradigm in Hacking. Old way of talking about things. Just to be clear, the ontology of physics, for example, is very familiar. It's the idea that the world is a fixed and knowable place waiting to be described by physicists. That's what their job is. This is something so obvious it seems hardly worth even bothering to say it. But then the interesting thing is that the ontology of cybernetics is completely different from that. Cybernetics somehow presumed and reproduce what I sometimes call an ontology of unknowability. The idea here is not that the world is fixed and knowable, but that we'll never get to the bottom of this world that we live in. The world is always going to be able to surprise us. So that's the contrast in ontologies. It seems pretty daring of cybernetics to suggest that the world isn't the way modern physics describes it. But what interests me most isn't just you know, these competing ideas about ontology, but the ways in which they're translated into practice. So ontologies play themselves out as practices in the systematically different practices in the world. Oddly enough, it helps me at least to think about Heidegger and his famous essay, The Question Concerning Technology, in this context. The modern ontology, the ontology of physics and sciences like that, fits in a pretty obvious way with a stance in the world, a way of going on, a way of acting, that Heidegger called enframing, which I take to mean domination through knowledge. If you know how things are arranged in the world, you've got your hands on the levers of power. You can dictate to things and also people how they should act to serve your purposes. Right? That's what Heidegger called enframing. But I want to associate cybernetics with the other pattern of action that Heidegger called poesis, or revealing, which is a systematically different way of going on. If the world is unknowable, if it's always unpredictably becoming something new, you just can't dominate it through knowledge. You can't order it about. Just about the only thing you can do, something I came up with the other night, is to kind of keep prodding it, pushing it, stimulating it to see how it's going to react, and then you react to whatever comes back in response to your prodding, and so on and so forth. Kind of process of adaptation. This is what Gordon Pass, incidentally, meant by conversation. It's reciprocal. Reciprocal prodding. And, you know, the point to emphasize is this is a very different way of going on from our usual enframing way of dominating people and things. Right, that's the ontology in action stuff. It gets us to the two papers I sent along. In different ways, both of these papers are just trying to put some flesh on these ideas about ontology and action in cybernetics. I can't go through them briefly. There's the paper that's called The Science of the Unknowable, which is about Stafford Beer's management cybernetics. I included this paper because it was somehow about information. It runs through a series of Stafford Beer's major projects running from the 1950s until about 2000. The automatic factory, biological computing, the viable system model, disintegration, ending up with Beer's very distinctive non-standard form of spirituality. And it's interesting to see all these things as joining up with one another. The most amazing bit of this history is probably the biological computing stuff, where the idea was to try and use mice or pons or small children to manage factories. It's very hard to get to grips with what's going on there. But it starts to make sense if you think of the brain as a performative organ that acts in its environment and reacts to what it finds. The brain does this kind of prodding thing. And any adaptive biological system is continually prodding and adapting to the world that it's in. That's the logic of that whole project. One other feature that might be worth mentioning in advance is that quite a few people seem to see a relation between Stafford Beer's work and big data. People often ask me about that. I could just say that I'm struck by, in a way, the opposite. The point of the viable system model was actually to filter out and throw away almost all of the information that was coming in on firms and organizations. Get rid of it. And the idea of getting rid of it is, if the world's always becoming something new, it's a waste of time hoarding a record of every single thing that ever happened in the past. Which is, of course, the project of big data. Well, what Beer wanted to do was just hang on to what he called cries for help, exceptional bits of information that needed action. The other paper I sent along was Cybernetics and the Politics of the Dark Universe. I included this because people are always arguing about the politics of cybernetics. I like it. I mean, that's why I wrote about it. I called my book Sketches of Another Future, and I kind of meant that. But there's this critique that goes all the way back to the very start, 1948, that sees cybernetics as just a tool for controlling the masses, keeping them in line. These days, that critique is continually being rehearsed by this collective called Tikkun. You can find it on the web everywhere. The quote I remember is, cybernetics is the war against all that lives. You can hardly be in favor of that, can you? That's pure Adam Curtin. So I tried to sort out the arguments about the politics of cybernetics by distinguishing between two different lines of cybernetic development. And these, for me, are marked out by the different exemplary machines that they grow out of. The primary referent of American cybernetics was simple feedback devices like thermostats. And I think, you know, the Tikkun critique is right about that line of cybernetics. It's a rather negative science of control in a classical sense. If you model society on servo mechanisms, maybe you end up with war against all that lives. Blotting out all fluctuations. But the primary referent of British cybernetics, which is what I know about, was a different machine. It was Ross Ashby's homeostat. And the nice thing about the homeostat is that it's not just a reactive device that picks up fluctuations and tries to kill them. Homeostats explore their environment and they adapt to whatever they find. They're continually prodding their world and responding to it. So homeostats are a little model of the kind of revealing and poesis that I talked about. And, you know, trying to think a bit further about this, I talked about two different versions of homeostat cybernetics. There's an asymmetric one, which could be even more dreadful than the servo mechanism one. Violent way of trying to make other people adjust to us. And a symmetric one, which is the one that strikes me as politically the most promising. And the last thing I thought of mentioning is that obviously by politics here, I'm not thinking about political parties and things like that. I'm talking about a kind of practical politics, which interests me a lot, about ways of being and acting in the world, which I think of as inherently political. Which is why I ended up in this the Dark Universe paper, talking about two women and strange musical instruments, Clara Rockmore and the theremin and Julie Wilson Bukovietz and the body coding. I just remembered this morning, of course, what I was trying to do there was make contact with Donna Haraway and her famous manifesto for cyborg. She wants to see something politically promising in the figure of the cyborg. But I think at the end of that paper, she's just run out of ideas. She can't find any real examples. She starts talking about science fiction and women wired into spaceships and things like that. Whereas I thought these two women and their musical instruments were beautiful examples of real cyborgs, strongly coupled to material system, exploring the unknown. And Julie Wilson especially, she had new feelings when she's interacting with this machine that we don't have a word for. I found that very interesting. There's another angle on politics I didn't talk about in this paper, which has to do with decision-making arrangements and variety reduction, if you know that technical term. To make decisions, the question is, how do you reduce political variety? Can you do it without creating and reproducing hierarchies of power? Existing political decision-making definitely just reduces variety by reproducing these hierarchies. And Stafford Beer's viable system model and disintegration art seems to be a very interesting alternative for those ways of reducing variety. But I thought that was enough to introduce Simon.
Okay, hello everyone. I have no idea why I've been chosen. Every single one of you knows much, much more about cybernetics in all its 57 varieties than I do. I'm a historian. This isn't even, as they say in my trade, my period. And what I know about it is overwhelmingly based on what Andy tells us. So I'm a hopeless commentator. He's a great writer, which is one of the reasons why the mangling of the Stafford Beer piece is terrible.
Oh, really?
Since the mid-90s, he's guided a lot of us through objects and materials and lives of which one was, to put it bluntly, absolutely innocent. And I think there are two features of the work, especially the two papers that every single one of us has read, which seem to me to be very striking. One is they're extraordinarily timely. I think that this is not an exercise in, as one might say, industrial archaeology. On the contrary, this is genealogical in the strict sense of the term. That's very, very striking, and you'll have a great deal to say about that. I mean, it's striking in the public sphere. We're 2 days after Alan Curtis's release, Hypernormalization, which is the 3-hour televisual version of some of the things that Andy's work has been addressing for the last 20, 25 years. In the current issue of Tate magazine, Tate Galleries magazine, Orrick Halpern has a piece on Negroponte's catastrophic experiments with Mongolian gerbils in New York City in 1970, which says very, very similar things to some of the things that Andy wants us to think about. And the last time I was in this building was to hear Bruno Latour talk to us about Gaia and world systems theory, using resources and vocabulary, though for a very different purpose. We can talk about that if you want. I hope we don't. that Andy is addressing. So timely. Secondly, and obviously the Beer piece suggests itself, especially since he's sitting behind us, is the reflexivity of biography that plays an absolutely decisive role in Andy's tactics. The cybernetic brain, as we all know, is, after all, a prosopography. It's many other things, but it's that. And it seems to me there's something very interesting to think about tactically in what is being done when the underdetermination, open-endedness, and unpredictability of life and career is in play in order to show the viability of an ontology that takes seriously the unpredictability, underdetermination and open-endedness of certain kind of technical knowledge, political, social forms of engineering. There's something very interesting there, whether one's thinking about Ronnie Lang or whether one's thinking about Beer. So I think there's something quite interesting, certainly from my part of the trade union, which is what that underdetermination of career, of life, might amount to. Remember what the slogan. So the slogan is that we're after, and I quote, a neo-Daoist image of endless descent and flows and becomings. And a lot of the work is to put flesh on those bones and to show how that might become so. So two things seem to me to flow from those observations. One, a constant pressure that Andy has already referred to, not to refute or reject or undermine, but simply to clear away for a moment of reflection the inevitable and violent political critique launched against the work. If one goes back with Andy to, let's say, the 1960 paper by Manfred Kleins on the cyborg, where the term is coined, the politics there is on the face of the page. The people who pay for the work, what it's for, how it functions, how the notion of the cyborg is defined, all of that seems, in a certain sense, too easy to read. Right? And I think one has to take very seriously the methodologico-critical position that Andy's work in both papers we have wants to adopt, which is not to say, look, Takuda's just wrong. I mean, let's get clear on that, though I think they are. But simply to clear a certain kind of space. And that's a much more interesting move, which I think it behoves us to reflect on. And there's a great deal to say about that. There's a great deal to say in the, as it were, public literary career of Pickering on cybernetics, which begins in the mid-90s, but as Andy has just pointed out, obviously has a much older presence already, I think, in Constructing Quartz, but certainly in the Manglebook, even though the word is not used in the Manglebook. The conjuncture of the mid to late 90s is absolutely decisive for him and for those of us who were functioning then for the rest of us. I strongly recommend Andy's review of Paul Edwards' Closed World for these purposes, because Closed World is one of the key texts for the critique, and that debate is already there. When's that? 97, 96, 97. But a second, perhaps more substantial point comes through very strongly in, I think, the very moving evocation of Theremin. And in the discussion of some aspects of the later work of Beer, Chile, and after, is what is the appropriate, as it were, moral stance? What is the appropriate affect with which to make sense of what Andy wants us to call symmetric cybernetics? And it seems to me one of the key words, and I think we can think about this quite a lot, is coping. I mean, this is not a Pink Floyd citation, hanging on in quiet desperation is the English way, but it's a bit like that. This is about coping strategies. And the history of psychotherapy, back to Winnicott, is very, very important there. Well, if you look in the OED under coping, you learn something absolutely fascinating, which is that it has the same root as coupé, to cut. In the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, coping meant war. Cope was to fight right through into the 18th century. And it gradually becomes, through early and then high modernity, something much more pacific, in which all the power is then transferred from the agent that is doing the coping to the agent with which you have to cope. And now it's perhaps the most ironic, the most pacific verb we've got. And I think that move is quite suggestive. Let me read one of my favourite texts on coping. As you can imagine, I have a little cardboard box just under the desk, which is full of uses of the word coping. This is my favourite one. So you've never heard of this guy, Ivor Brown. So Ivor Brown was an interlocutor of Pat. He was a theatre critic. Was an art historian. He writes this in 1958. She suffers from copelessness. I've heard this said of an unsatisfactory employee. The use of cope as a verb by itself to describe dealing with all kinds of situations excuse me, is a recent, very recent usage for a 1958. In my youth, says Brown, we tried, or we were told to try, to cope with this or that problem. And he finishes, we were not then required to cope in general. So coping in general seems to me to be absolutely crucial as a way of thinking about symmetric cybernetics. That the world might be such a place and made of such things that one's relationship with it is prodding and coping rather than in framing and mastery is, I think, about as radical a thought as Andy is constantly arguing it is. Why it is then opens us up to the kind of political debates that he wants us to reflect on. Two more points and then I'll shut up. One is just a technical point. Andy, quote, cannot imagine. Let me get the quote right. Sorry.
It's probably Andy, a typo.
No, yeah, probably is. He says, I have no idea whether contemporary neoliberalism owes anything historically to cybernetics. Mm. Probably not. Probably it just accumulated piecemeal. And he says that several times. Neoliberalism probably owes very little to technical developments in cybernetics. I think that's wrong.
Oh, okay.
I think that's absolutely true. But what I want to know is why that seems so plausible. So I think the second order question is very interesting for us. Why is it that for Tikkun, but not just for Tikkun, for neoliberalism's friends precisely, a cybernetic genealogy is extremely welcome and good news, Hayek being the locus classicus. Hayek constantly, right through the 50s, wants to find a cybernetic ancestry for his own psychological, political, and economic project. He's wrong. Of course he's wrong. He was wrong about everything. But why that? This isn't just the critique, then. Right? It's those guys who also wanted there to be an alliance between cybernetic ontologies and not just Wiener's, in fact, particularly not Wiener's cybernetic ontologies, and their own political programs. Hayek's characterization of the market as a system of information storage under massive uncertainty, his denunciation precisely of command economy, his diagnosis of the socialist command problem, which we're going to hear about in 2 weeks' time, I strongly imagine, and if we don't, then just read Francis Buffett's Red Plenty. That'll tell you all you need to know. Is, I think, absolutely fascinating because it tells you a lot historically about what it was assumed cybernetics was offering, and it tells you a great deal about a particular dialectic that I think one can press on both of the papers, especially the Stafford Beer one, that are on the table today. What I mean by that is this is a control system that announces it isn't. That's what's important about the neoliberal dream that it had a cybernetic granddad. That it wanted both those resources in play. And Hayek's writings are very striking on this. But one can find stuff in Ashby and Bateson that looks like that. Again, you know, I only know about this because of Andy. But in 1945, writing in very significantly, I think, Nature, not in any political economy magazine, Ross Ashby attacks post-war British Attlee Stafford Cripps attempts to fix any rapidly changing variable in the market. In other words, rationing, central control of house prices, any of those things. On the grounds that the system will be massively destabilized if you intervene in the economy like that. To which Bateson, in a magnificent turn of phrase, in a letter that's in the British Library Archive, writes, we're in 1946, I can well imagine that a government desiring to control some economic variable might tie up with wire the balls of a centrifugal governor. In the social system, do not think about that metaphor too much. But this is Ashby and Bateson assaulting democratic socialist planning in the name of the autonomy of a certain kind of market, using not just the language but the objects of massively asymmetric cybernetics. So there's an interesting question there. We might want to pursue that. I'm not sure what the implications are. Final point in the riff is what is to be said in the end, then, about the shift, and it's a really significant shift in our part of the forest, in science studies and history of science technology, massively away from representation towards performance. What else goes along with that? I think that's the direction of travel of the work that Andy has offered us to read. What I want to ask, I don't know the answer to this, what I want to ask is, it must be the case that a more than normative rejection of representational idioms has a profound effect on the appropriate institutional forms of life, both within and out with the academy, especially for those who are doing science as well as those who comment on it, who want to intervene in it. The reason for this, or there are many reasons for this, but one obvious reason for this, is that the traditional position of critique has been the need for planning. Precisely. That what we need is to align technoscience with, and more perfectly with, the actual demands and needs of a progressive society. But that model absolutely depends on the epistemology that Andy wants us to give up on. So what kinds of alternative critique and intervention, what kinds of institutional forms are therefore to be in play, especially in an age of massive scarcity? I think that is going to be a really critical set of issues within STS, but also within sociology studies, as well as out with it over the next period. One can think about the importance that Andy's work precisely gives to small to medium scale construction. And I think that's a very, very interesting line, at least for us, within science studies, within history of science, to reflect on. My hero in that story has always been a bloke, whom some of you will have heard of, I guess, called Gustav Metzger, who was a protagonist of almost all the events and rallies and meetings and get-togethers that appear in Andy's work. He was at Cybernetic Serendipity, he was at the Imperial College Cybernetics Conference in 1969-70, and so on. His politics are related to, but in the end very, very different from, the British cyberneticians. And they point to a very different, it seems to me, relationship with the politics of techno-science. But that's for another day. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon. Brilliant.
Sure. Okay, well, Andrew, do you want to respond to any of that there? And
I mean, just quickly, a couple of things. I mean, as usual, Simon said so many suggestive things, I couldn't even write them down. It'd take about a week to reply to them all. But the last one was kind of interesting. I mean, Gustav Metzger, he's the auto-destructive.
He's auto-destructive,
right? You know, a very negative kind of image.
That's true.
Technology. Which goes back to this coping trip of yours. Right? I mean, you know, it's the war end of coping, as well as Gustav is concerned. I mean, what I wanted to say is that none of those senses of coping that you use really quite catch what interests me about homeostat cybernetics, because the homeostat is supposed to stand for an entity that's always trying things that are new, right? So, you know, it's reacting to what comes back when it tries these things. And you could call that coping, but, you know, the next step might be kind of trying something else new. The model of this might be Donald Glaser trying to build a new instrument which ends up as being the bubble chamber in the air. I talk about in chapter 2 of the Mangle. But that kind of constructive exploration seems to get lost in that. And in the same sense, you know, it gets lost in Metzger's autodestructive art. Unlike, you know, Gordon Pask's Colloquy of Mobiles, also cybernetic serendipity, which is a bunch of robots that are actively doing things and kind of experimenting on one another. It's not just acid eating through some nylon fabric. In a way, the other question that stuck in my mind is it's the word genealogy in this, the Foucauldian phrase, history of the present. I'm not sure I see myself, you know, when Foucault talks about writing history of the present, he means kind of excavating the origins of dominant things in the world today that he doesn't like. You know? I see my history of cybernetics as a kind of history of something rather marginal, which is an alternative to the dominant present. And which, you know, has to do with what is to be criticized. Anyway, okay, that's just a quick thing.